FM is a community radio station for Bristol.
So what exactly does that mean?
Well, it means that anybody can get involved in any way you want.
Yeah, but what if you haven't done radio before?
That doesn't matter, because BCFM have qualified tutors that run training courses that tell you everything you need to know.
To find out more information, go to www.bcfm.org.uk.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Okay, electronic or internet voting, how easy is it to hack into? We look at a recent documentary on the topic entitled Hacking Democracy. But first, Marina Morris is joining us. Marina, what have you got for us today?
Hello. The average UK employee in full-time job works for 1.5 hours a week, more than European Union average worker. The UK worker works an average 41.4 hours a week. At the same time, the UK has one of the worst heart attack rates in the world. Someone has a heart attack every 2 minutes in Britain. The question is, there is a problem. Is it long working hours or an unhealthy lifestyle? And how can we protect yourself? A significant amount of our time is spent in the high-pressure environment and long hours of many full-time jobs. Not everyone can thrive in this environment. You can sometimes change your job for part-time work, but is it right way for you? And could you still afford a normal standard of living? The study published in the journal Heart examined data from almost 5,000 men aged 40 to 58 from 14 different companies. Their fitness level were tracked over 30 years. The men completed cycling exercise test to assess their fitness and provides details on the average number of hours they worked every week. Around 70% of men worked between 41 and 45 hours a week, while around 20% worked longer hours. Unfit men who work long hours double their risk of dying from heart disease compared to men working less than 40 hours. Exercise seems to be the key to health, with fit men who work long hours having no increased risk of dying from heart disease. This seems to be good news locally. Most of full-time workers questioned during our vox pop either used a gym or does a different form of exercise and feel fit. Also, recent exploration of the mind have given us a new possibilities and insight into our health. Our health is the total sum of physical, emotional, and mental health, which all interconnect. The greatest of our resources is the unexploited potential of our brain. You can do your job to a better quality in less time if you turn on your brain computer in the right way. Psychologists supporting positive behavioral therapy teach us how important it is to release from your brain all negative memories, information, or bad feelings. By doing this, you can invigorate yourself and unblock your progress. Use this knowledge. Don't allow yourself to be unhealthy. With this attitude, you can be healthy in the job you want with a good salary and can fulfill your dreams.
Thanks, Marina. And you've been out on the streets this week also asking people about a very same problem, haven't you?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to what people had to say about their working hours.
How many hours do you work in a week? And can long working hours affect your health?
I work 8 hours every day and I have 5 shifts a day, so it means 40 hours a week. Well, you can always feel tired. You have not enough time for your family, for you yourself, for your husband, for children, for everything. You need time to relax, to be away from work, to be ready for the next shift. It's very important to me personally. But if you haven't got enough time, so you won't be even ready for the next day. So it can affect your work as well.
I can't work at the moment because I've got in bad back. Like, if you work long hours, it can affect your health. You can get overtired and you can start getting, well, you could become ill, couldn't you, if you got overtired?
We're students. Have a part-time job. Yeah, just generally. And it was probably, you're probably quite depressed as well because you're not gaining any benefits from exercising.
How do you maintain your health?
Exercise. I do not exercise. I do walk a lot. To me, it's better because I enjoy walking. We do play badminton once a while. I love swimming.
With difficulty. But I do it. I go to the gym once or twice a week, and my partner and I walk at the weekends if we can, and go on walking holidays. So
go to the gym before and during work. Make sure you leave work at least once a week early so you can spend time with your family, and try to keep the weekends free.
So I finish early in the afternoon, so it gives me more time for myself, which is good. Try and eat healthily, do a lot of walking, just to try and keep a balanced life, stress-free if possible.
Yeah, I can go exercise. I've got a gym pass on me now, like, in my back pocket. My brother owns a gym. To keep fit, walking to keep him fit, a few press-ups to keep you fit, doing a few twists to keep you fit, maintaining health and, like, exercise.
Why do we work so many hours?
I should imagine it's job security, really. At the end of the day, that's what it's all about. And if you work well and your employers are happy with you, then you stand a good chance of staying there.
Well, I would assume, I still think that working hours never do you good, except maybe, well, good salary. Sometimes even the salary is the same. And I would think that in shorter hours time, you can do the same amount of work if you are healthy, if you are happy. Yeah, it doesn't mean that you work long hours and you achieve more. I can do everything in shorter time, and I can have more time for my family, for myself, to be happy, to enjoy life. That is.
That was Marina Morris's Vox Pops out on the street of Bristol, streets of Bristol this week, asking you what you think about working hours and really staying fit and healthy. Martin, why is it that in Britain we have the longest working hours of anywhere in Europe?
Because we have gone for a more American-style free market model than countries like France or Sweden, where they have a very strong state regulation of matters of this kind.
And do you think overall it does actually affect people's health, as Marina was suggesting there?
I think it's a common sense, logical thing to suggest that it does. I mean, even if exercise helps, having more free time means you've got more free time to take exercise, doesn't it?
Now, I mean, one of the sort of slightly peculiar aspects to all this is we hear about the postman being asked to run as part of their job. Now, actually, that's a way of keeping fit too. Isn't that quite a positive thing?
Well, yes, but I mean, but also it can be too much as well. I mean, we in France they passed a law to give everybody a 35-hour week in the 80s, socialist government of France, and that's something now that which people really really value. They've got more time for their families. I mean, the French basically would have a higher standard of living if they worked more hours. But they've quite rationally decided we don't want a higher standard of consuming, we want a higher standard of living, which means we'd rather have our time, we'd rather have our productivity taken as more time off rather than more stuff. And I think that's the key to health, is to have enough stuff and no more, and then start looking at leisure time. Basically, leisure time is the realm of freedom. That's where you read stories to your children and all the rest of it. And if people are working too many hours, they don't do those things. And then the society, in the end, suffers. Our society is a stressed society on the edge of a nervous breakdown because we're all worried, we're all working so hard to keep our jobs. Because if we're not prepared to put the hours in, we'll lose our jobs. It's not a question of personal choice, is it? That's why the government stepped in France in the 80s and said, right, we're going to put a 35-hour week. That's the top. And that's worked very well for France. They're probably a little bit poorer as a result of that. But in many ways, they're richer than us.
Thanks, Martin. Well, opposition to EDF's plans to build a nuclear reactor at Hinkley Point is growing, with the District Council this week down near Bridgwater, Sedgemoor, expressing very serious concerns about the proposals just days after a protest was held on the environmental impact. Sedgemoor District Council is set to raise what it calls very serious concerns over EDF's proposals for Hinkley Point C nuclear power station at a special full council meeting next Wednesday. Well, looking ahead at that, I'm joined now by Crispin Aubrey from the Stop Hinkley campaign. Hi, Crispin.
Hi.
Now, first of all, let's get it straight. What qualifications do you have? Are you a scientist?
No, I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist by trade, but I've been writing about energy issues, including both nuclear power and renewable energy, since something like 1986. So I've read an awful lot of scientific and other technical literature, so I feel pretty well qualified to talk about it.
Now, OK, tell us about our three nuclear sites around the Bristol Channel, Hinkley, Oldbury and Barkley.
Right. Well, Barkley is one of the older nuclear power stations, is in shut down and being decommissioned, although that's a very, very long process. Oldbury is still operating, but has a proposal for one of these new EDF, well, it's not actually EDF, new nuclear reactors or power stations. Hinkley Point has one old power station shut down, has one still operating due to close in about 5 or 6 years, and there are plans there for the very first of the new wave of nuclear power stations called Hinkley C, you've already mentioned, proposed by EDF, virtually the national French electricity company. It would be the biggest nuclear power station ever built in the country. And we, like many other people, are deeply opposed to it. Do you want me to explain the reasons why?
Well, not yet, because I'm a little bit concerned at Hinkley. Yep. You say there's already one station, I think that's the old Magnox station, yep, which is now out of commission. There's another one which has got a few years to go. Now, the actual radiation from these plants carries on for tens or possibly even hundreds of thousands of years, and yet it seems that the actual life of these plants themselves isn't all that long, maybe 20, 30 years.
Well, just as an example, the power station they want to build, they say it's a new design, never been built in this country before, never been erected. It would operate producing electricity for 60 years if all goes well. But for at least 100 years after that, they would store radioactive waste on the site at Hinkley, partly because it's very hot and they can't move it anywhere, but also because they don't have anywhere else to put it. And of course, this is one of our fundamental objections, that not only is it totally unsustainable to have this radioactive waste legacy after the power station stopped operating, but there is nowhere in Britain or any other country in the world where there is an existing store or repository or dump or whatever you want to call it to put this very highly radioactive waste. We've already got all the stuff that was taken out of Hinkley A, which you've mentioned. There'll be lots of stuff from other nuclear power stations in Britain as they close down. They want to add more to it without any solution actually in action. So I think as far as the sort of safety concerned, that is one of the biggest objections.
Isn't the best thing to do with these sort of nuclear waste, including bits of old, rusted old power stations that are now out of commission, isn't the best thing to do just bury it?
Well, there are various solutions. I mean, none of them are very satisfactory, which is why we're saying don't go ahead with any more. But the government solution is to gather it all in one place. I mean, bury it is a crude description. They do want to put it in some sort of protective container and put it underground in sort of an endless trail of caverns, which itself would cost billions of pounds to create. But the trouble is, you're talking about the sort of thousands of years you've just described for this stuff to last. We're possibly bequeathing to our children's children's children a problem that may be in the next 1,000 years. There are earthquakes, there are all sorts of other disruptions. There's just no knowing what might happen to that waste over that period of time. And I think that is one of the simplest ways of explaining to people that nuclear power is just not a sustainable way to produce electricity. Whilst if you had a wind farm, for instance, once it's finished its life, if you wanted to, you could take all the towers, the blades, the concrete away, and you'd have nothing left except fields.
But the thing is, of course, that these nuclear power stations produce far more electricity. And as you said, this is a first of its type. It's apparently to be built here in Britain. What sort of characteristics does this new type of nuclear power station have?
On your point about the amount of electricity it produces, This is really a second string to our opposition, apart from the safety aspects. And this is the illusion that's been created and also taken on board by a lot of people who would call themselves green, that the lights will go out if we do not have nuclear. And that's based on the fact that, yes, of course, this power station and the others would, when they're operating, produce a lot of electricity. But if you look at where our electricity comes from now, the plans by the government for renewable energy, the target is for something like 30% of our electricity come from renewable sources by 2020. It's quite feasible for us to continue to have electricity to keep the lights on for industry and homes without relying on nuclear. There are plenty of projections that show that we can continue to use fossil fuels until we gradually phase those out. Renewable energy will take over. We save energy. So these large amounts of electricity are not needed.
Hang on a minute, because you're talking about burning fossil fuels there. We have to get our power now, surely, in a way which doesn't cause global warming.
Well, the fact is, at the moment, we get quite a large proportion of our electricity from both coal and gas. Gas is better than coal because it produces half the amount of carbon dioxide. I'm not saying that we go on using those forever, but if we don't want to have nuclear, we will for a while have to continue to use those power stations and gradually phase them out. And I would prefer to have gas-fired stations built to fill the gap until renewables come online than to have new nuclear power stations. You'd have to accept that that is a possibility.
Yes, but I mean, the global warming thing, surely this is one of the main concerns nowadays, that anything that's new is made, we make sure that it isn't doing this, isn't producing global warming.
Okay, well, that's fair enough, and nuclear has the only advantage is that it produces less carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas, than a fossil fuel. But it also has these other major disadvantages, which is a reason why we shouldn't use it. I mean, I would personally like us to forge ahead as fast as possible with renewables so we don't have to build any gas-fired stations. And in fact, if you looked at the Liberal Democrat manifesto before they were elected to the coalition government, they had a target, as the Liberal Democrats, to produce all our electricity from renewable energy by 2050. Now, that is feasible, but it requires an enormous commitment by the government. That's what I would like to see. I'm just being realistic about what might happen.
Now, surely the whole process is scrutinised by government and the planning system, so ultimately you don't even really need to protest, you just need to get involved in the planning system.
Well, we're doing both. The trouble is, what has happened since there was a proposal to build a power station at Hinkley C in the 1980s, when that happened, there was a proper local public inquiry in which the Stomp Hinkley, then called Stomp Hinkley Expansion, was involved. We produced evidence. We could cross-examine the people who were proposing the nuclear power station. And that was a proper investigation which involved local people. Well, because the government decided it didn't like that process, it thought it was too long, it's invented something called the Infrastructure Planning Commission. So the new power station proposed at Hinkley won't be decided locally. It will be decided by this thing called the IPC, which is actually based in Bristol. We don't know where the hearings will be, but this will involve no cross-examination of the EDF or the proposers of the power station, and no local hearings. So democracy has really been substantially limited by that. So we feel perfectly entitled to protest. We also want to change the government's view. We've now got a coalition government where, as I say, half the equation, the Liberal Democrats, had a policy before the election of no new nuclear power stations. We'd like them to stick to their guns and not be bulldozed by the Tories into going down the nuclear route. So there's a lot of potential openings, quite apart from the sort of public inquiry thing you've talked about, which, as I've explained, isn't an option anymore.
Now, what did you actually do as part of your protest? This is about a week or so ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, we had a whole weekend of activities, including talks from people from Greenpeace and other organisations. And then on the Sunday, we went out to Hinkley Point. And what we were showing people, I mean, we held a protest outside the gates, but what we were emphasising was that there's an area there of about 400 plus acres, so the size of a medium-sized farm, which is where EDF want to build this power station. Now, before they ever go to this the IPC process I've described, where they have to go to get approval for the power station, they are proposing to do what they call preliminary works. Now, preliminary works sounds fairly mild, but what it actually means is that they're going to completely raise this 400 acres. They're going to take away all the trees and hedges. They're going to level the site. they're going to excavate more soil and rocks and other stuff that was than has been excavated to prepare the site for the 2012 London Olympic Games. They're going to build a jetty out into the sea. So basically, they're going to prepare the site ready to build their nuclear power station. And we're saying it's quite unacceptable that they should do that before they've actually got permission to build it, because apart from all the other factors I've explained to do with government policy, there are an awful lot of economic doubts about whether this is actually going to be a runner.
Okay.
Can I just chip in on that point about the economics of nuclear power, which have always been completely dependent upon state subsidy and intervention, which is why you've got a state-run nuclear industry in France. When the City of London looked at privatisation of nuclear power in the 1980s, they had a good look at it and decided this is not viable in the private sector because of the on costs of the waste and the potential for court suits and so on. And if we are going to have government intervention, I'd rather see it on the side of renewables rather than nuclear power.
Well, I would agree with that. I mean, the government is supporting renewables now, which is why you're seeing these massive offshore wind farms being built, which is great. That is fantastic. It's true. And one good thing is the coalition government has said that it will not allow any state support for new nuclear power stations. And I think that's given EDF a lot of pause for thought. If they stick to their guns, it would be very difficult for EDF to go ahead, because they've already said that they want some sort of covert support. I mean, it's not as simple as a subsidy, but it is in effect shifting the economic balance so that nuclear looks more favourable compared with fossil fuels. They've asked the government to do that, and the government has said they will do it. So there's quite a lot of doubt about the economics. And just one simple statistic, the cost of building this power station, there were two reactors, one power station. Each reactor a little while ago was thought to cost about £4 billion to build. The latest figures suggests it might be as much as £6 billion each. So that's £12 billion. That's an enormous increase in costs. And even EDF, which, as I say, is pretty well owned by the French government, are going to have to think long and hard. So I think people should not think that this is in any way a foregone conclusion. Just because it's a big French company involved doesn't mean they're actually going to go ahead.
The problem with EDF is, and the French nuclear industry as a whole, is they've really invested so much money in it over the years, so that something like 80% of their electricity is generated by nuclear. They've got to sell on to other people like Britain or somebody else in order to defray the costs, the investments they've already made. And the other point I'd like to make on the economics, of course, is what we really need to do is save energy. Instead of saying we need X amount of kilowatt hours to have our existing lifestyle, we all know that the technology for reducing energy consumption is already there. Why don't we enforce it through energy standards in new building, for example, and reduce our energy footprint? That's the real solution.
Now, Crispin Aubrey from Stop Hinkley, can you let us know, because I know Chris Busby has been doing done several surveys in different parts of the country and has found that there are actually cancer clusters associated with the existing Hinkley power station site.
That's correct. He's done some studies on behalf of Stop Hinkley around Burnham-on-Sea, which is basically downwind from the existing Hinkley site, sort of between the Hinkley site and Bristol, so I suppose, yeah. And there there have been a number of studies that have shown excess cancers. The authorities say dismiss this as just anecdotal, but Chris not only has found these excess cancers, but he also challenges the model which is used to show the relationship between radiation from the power station and people's health. So that's a big challenge and very important. And, of course, I should mention that you can go and find all this sort of information, including information on what your friend just said about energy saving at the Stop Hinkley website, which is very simply sort of stophinkley.org. So please go there. We produce these very good display panels which show both the downside of nuclear and all the alternatives in terms of energy saving and renewables.
Well, with the fears about Iran and its nuclear program in mind, what are the connections, if any, between nuclear power at Hinkley Point and nuclear weapons?
Well, it's quite interesting. The Magnox series of reactors, which Hinkley A is an example, it was opened in 1965. Those first nuclear power stations, one of the reasons that they have an awful lot of waste, they produce an awful lot of waste material, is that they were designed not just to produce electricity, but they were designed to produce plutonium for the British bombs. So there's a very close tie between nuclear power for peaceful means and nuclear power for weapons. And I believe, although I haven't got the information in front of me, that the Iranians originally got their technology partly from Russia and partly from Germany. So you can easily see how a leaching of the technology from the Western countries, which were the countries that have developed nuclear power to its highest level, and countries like Iran, who may, I mean, it's not been proved, have some other agenda in terms of weapons. Or look at the Israelis. The Israelis have nuclear weapons. I think it is a real cause for concern. And although there's no evidence that British nuclear technology has been used for weapons, there's still always the potential that some terrorist group might get hold of some nuclear material and produce what is often called a dirty bomb, a very crude nuclear weapon, and threaten people with blowing it up. So I think it's one of those. It's one of the many safety issues that is concerned to do with nuclear power.
Now, Prince Charles appears to be backing EDF's plans. His green train that he was chugging around the country on the week before last is being sponsored by EDF. And I think there's a growing number of people, including Prince Charles, that actually see nuclear power as green energy.
There is this strand of green thinking. I mean, I think it's exaggerated. I mean, Greenpeace, for instance, has never wavered. Greenpeace is the biggest environmental pressure group in this country, and Greenpeace has never wavered in its opposition to nuclear power. But there are some people who've been persuaded, I think as much by the argument that I was addressing earlier about the lights going out. They think that if we're really... Well, that and a mixture of the low-carbon economy, people cannot get their heads around the fact that we can go forward without nuclear. I mean, EDF is keen to get to get a good image in this country, and it doesn't only isn't only involved in building nuclear power stations. It also runs until recently it owned quite a lot of the electricity supply companies, including what used to be called SWEB. So it's sort of and also it just for your interest, it does build wind farms. So it doesn't only do nuclear. But I think we have to be very wary of this argument that nuclear is somehow going to contribute to our green future. As I said, if you look at the projections which you can find on the Stop Hinkley website, you can see how it's quite feasible to do it, to get our supply without nuclear. And perhaps the best example of in Western Europe is Germany. Germany has it recently adapted its policy of what it's going to do with its existing nuclear power stations, but it still has a proposal to not... It has a policy of not building any new ones. And, of course, that has meant that they're going really strongly on building wind farms, solar-powered power stations, a whole raft of renewables. And they're being much more successful than we are because they firmly shut the door on nuclear and said, OK, renewables are the way forward. So you can find examples of other countries who are doing what we should be doing in this country.
Martin, can I just bring you in again here? Because, I mean, we're being told that EDF are preparing to level the site and get ready. Surely all your arguments about this being uneconomic are just nonsense if the people who are planning to build this power station are preparing to level the site and prepare for building.
Well, I think, as Crispin was just saying... they've been given understandings by the government that what they're doing will be underwritten. Although, as he says, the coalition should be in two minds about this. The Liberals should be opposing it. And I think the other problem is that once you've got nuclear power, like anything else, it becomes a self-fulfilling vested interest, which is one of the reasons why Milton Friedman didn't believe in any kind of government intervention, because once you create, through government intervention, a nuclear power industry, that nuclear power industry then is a vested interest which demands that more nuclear power should be produced. And the French nuclear power industry, in order to cover its own costs, and all of the money that's been invested by French taxpayers in it over the generations, has got to sell on even at a loss. Yeah, it's actually in your interest to build something at a loss if you're trying to defray the costs of your own nuclear power industry. So the economics of nuclear power, I wrote a paper about this in the 80s when they were trying to talk about what they were going to do with the nuclear power industry in Ukraine. I think what you've got to do is you've got to accept that once a nuclear power industry exists, you don't necessarily want to close it down overnight. But I don't think you really want to get yourself into a cul-de-sac where you are stuck with a nuclear power industry for generations to come. That we should avoid. And we should avoid it by saving energy and changing our lifestyle.
That's Martin's view. Crispin, what do you think is driving this new nuclear expansion?
Well, I think the point that Martin made earlier, that EDF are very keen to promote their new reactor, a new reactor. It's not actually made by EDF, it's made by a French company called Areva. Nothing to do with buses, but it's a French company, and there's one being built in Finland at the moment, and there's one being built in France, although both of them have had enormous number of problems and cost overruns, so they're not being built very successfully. But they want to sell this. It's their new design. They want to sell it to this country. They initially were allowed to buy British Energy, which is the company that runs all the more recent existing power stations like Hinkley B. The one I mentioned was due to close in 5 or 6 years. So they want a foothold for their for this new design in this country. And although I mentioned that EDF builds windmills, their real interest is in nuclear. And of course, although I'm not suggesting any sort of conspiracy, it's an interesting coincidence that the head of communications at EDF is the brother of Gordon Brown, the ex-prime minister, and it was under Gordon Brown's premiership that this pro-nuclear policy, which the Labour Party adopted, was pushed forward. And has now been at least partly taken over by the new coalition. So I think that's the agenda, and it's been greened with this gloss that nuclear power doesn't produce very much carbon dioxide. But people shouldn't be taken in by that. There are plenty of other ways of producing low carbon electricity. And as Martin has mentioned several times, there are also much more aggressive ways in which we can reduce our consumption in the first place.
So Sedgemoor District Council down around Bridgewater are going to be talking about this next Wednesday and their full council meeting. Where next for the Stop Hinkley campaign, Crispin?
Well, we're going to carry on, you know, with three fronts, really. We're providing information to try and the sort of things I've been talking about. And as I said, there's an awful lot of stuff at our website. So we'll continue to protest in various ways. But we're also going to be involved in all the various consultations. We'll be going along to this meeting of the council. There are actually two councils involved, Sedgemoor and the adjacent West Somerset. They're working together on their response to this. And there's an awful lot of people who are now not only concerned about EDF's plans to build a power station, they're also concerned about all the ramifications of that, the disruption to the local area, the traffic it will create, the noise it will create, and the lack of benefits. The local benefits. I mean, what are people going to get out of it? So those are the sort of issues that will be brought up at that meeting. And we also intend to be involved, although we're critical of it, we intend to be involved in this IPC process when that happens, if it happens. I mean, our aim is both to lobby locally and nationally to encourage the Liberal Democrat part of the coalition and other people who are opposed to nuclear power to drop the plans and not do anything at Hinkley at all, just leave the area undisturbed and allow the two existing power stations to gently rot away.
And are there any signs of the Liberal Democrats' manifesto pledge for no new nuclear? Any signs of their alliance with the Conservatives cracking on this one?
Well, I think it's important that they've made this statement about no financial support, no subsidy, because if that was followed to the letter, it would include, for instance, no government fallback in the case of a serious accident. At the moment, the nuclear operator's liability on insurance has an upper limit. I haven't got the figure on top of my head, but it would be considered peanuts compared with, say, the cost of a Chernobyl accident. So if the government throws all the insurance liability in the case of a serious accident or incident back on the industry, then that would change the economics. If they don't actually do the thing I was describing, the way of fixing the market to make nuclear better value than fossil fuels, then that would also make it difficult for EDF to go ahead. So the government has a role in addressing the economics of nuclear power, even if the full sort of Liberal Democrat policy of total opposition isn't revived. So we're very hopeful that all these things combined together will ditch the scheme.
And finally, let's just look at the decommissioning process, because what sort of stage is the old Magnox station at, which is now out of service? Is that actually being disassembled? And if so, who's paying for that?
Well, it closed down in 2000. Well, we're paying for it.
That's what I was going to chip in.
I mean, we're talking about tens of billions of pounds to pay for the decommissioning of these stations. That power station is now run by a national body, a government body called the National Decommissioning Authority. So basically, British taxpayers are paying for the decommissioning and for the waste disposal. And the big hole in the ground I talked about, which will be needed to get rid of the waste from Hinkley A and the other power stations, that will also be paid for by the government. EDF says that it will be contributing from if it builds Hinkley C. So the answer is Hinkley A, the fuel has been taken away, but the building is still there, and the expectation is it will stay there as a building for probably another 100 years before they go inside to take the rest of it away, because it's still radioactive, and sending people in there is considered too expensive. So decommissioning does not mean removing the power station. It means leaving something there for a very long time.
The actual cost of decommissioning Britain's existing nuclear power stations is astronomical, and most people don't realise that it's something like 2p. One report I was reading said 2p in the pound on income tax is spent on decommissioning Britain's nuclear power stations. I mean, when people go on about waste in government and, you know, the cost of the war in Iraq even, decommissioning Britain's nuclear power stations has already cost us lots more than that. And this, you know, people don't realise where their money goes. This is all done with sleight of hand, and people have no idea what the real costs of these kind of industries actually are.
Okay, Crispin, can you just remind us of your website on the internet, if people are interested in contacting you?
It's pretty easy. So it's www.stophinkley, that's all one word, lowercase, stophinkley, .org. And there's lots of information there. We've got a petition addressed to the government. We've got some postcards to send to Chris Hume reminding him of that Liberal Democrat policy that I mentioned. And I also should mention that if you've got some sort of people who are really interested in this subject, there is going to be a meeting about the nuclear power issue in Bristol over the weekend, 23rd, 24th of October. That's a meeting for people who want to take action. And it's a more complicated website, but it goes Stop Nuclear Power, that's all one word, .blogspot.com. So that's Stop Nuclear Power, all one word, .blogspot.com. And there you can get information about what's happening in Bristol. So I hope that would be of interest to your listeners.
Okay, Crispin Aubrey, journalist and campaigner for Stop Hinkley Campaign. Thanks ever so much for joining us on Drive Time this evening. And now, in a moment, we're going to be looking at hacking democracy. Is it possible that electronic voting machines can be simply hacked, and using a mouse you can change thousands of votes from one candidate to another? We'll be talking about that after some music.
some fair and blue. I don't know just what to do. I fall down on my bended knees and I talk to Jesus. If I please and I tell operator to give me long distance, tell him long distance to get me heaven. I tell heaven I want my Jesus and I see Jesus and tell him my trouble.
Was the Staple Singers with New Home from the Rough Guide to Gospel. That is on Rough Guides. There's many of those Rough Guides on all sorts of different subjects. Now, in May this year, there was a general election in the Philippines. The country has a history of interference from intelligence services in their political affairs, particularly the American Central Intelligence Agency. The combination of recession could put more pressure on election authorities right around the world to install electronic, even internet voting under the guise of cutting costs. Anyway, a new documentary called Hacking Democracy, which is still to be shown on British television, took a close look at the Philippines elections and how the system was wide open to hacking.
Well, if someone would have told me that in this system there's a living thing, an executable, modifiable program stored in the same place as the very data which is the most secure in this system, I would say you have to be misunderstanding something, crazy or lying.
Hari wrote a report for Black Box Voting, warning that this program, lurking in the memory card, could be used to change the result of an election. Diebold sent letters to officials across America denying that there was any executable code on the memory cards. During his research, Hari had discovered that Diebold's memory cards effectively allowed negative votes.
Placing the Ender card in this device and telling it to turn off its counting function and do its reporting function will now cause the voting machine to print out a tape reading the number of votes that it had just read. Oh my. Here's the tape.
Seven people said it could be hacked,
and we put through six and two.
Six no's no's and two yeses.
Oh my gosh, do you know what this means?
How do we know that Hari didn't just change the report and the votes themselves on the memory card are still correct?
If I had not seen what was behind this, I'd have no reason not to. I would have certified this election as a true and accurate result of a vote.
That was a short extract there from the new documentary Hacking Democracy, brought out after the elections in the Philippines this May. But could it be the old-fashioned paper ballots and ballot boxes are actually a lot more secure than these so-called modern electronic voting systems? Well, they may be cheaper, but what price democracy? Martin Summers is joining me again. Martin, this company that they were talking about on the documentary there called Diebold, or Diebold, they actually do these election machines for the in the United States, don't they?
Yeah, and I wasn't quite clear whether they were involved in the Philippines election as well. Is that the implication of that clip? Well, if I was living in the Philippines, I'd be extremely worried about that, because there's masses of evidence to suggest that Diebold machines can indeed be hacked and have indeed been hacked in US elections in recent years. And I'm thinking now particularly of the Kerry-Bush election, where the key constituency of Ohio, John Conyers, who was a congressman, and JFK Jr. were both looking into the potential, but the actual hacking of Diebold's machines in that election, which probably gave the second term to Bush when it should have gone to Kerry. That's pretty important stuff. The most powerful man in the world got there by cheating, not once, but twice.
But how can you prove this?
I would ask people to look into this. I mean, I haven't got the details to my fingertips. I didn't even know we were going to be covering this issue today. If they look up John F. Kennedy Jr., they will see that what he was saying about all of this before he died in mysterious circumstances. And in fact, another person died in mysterious circumstances, whose name I've forgotten, who was actually the technical person for the Republicans' election campaign. And he was about to testify about aspects of electronic voting, which were basically fraudulent.
Now, one of the things that woke me up to this a little bit was a website called whatreallyhappened.com. Yeah. And they have a whole section on vote fraud. Yeah. And this is after not the last US elections, but the ones before. They put up a big map there where they showed basically every single state in the US. And they had a little symbol to show whether they were using paper ballots or electronic ballots. And then underneath that, in each state, they had another little chart explaining, on the one hand, what the exit polls were for the Republican candidates and the Democrat candidate, and then on the other side, what the actual result was. And in every single state in the US that had decided to use this electronic voting method, the exit poll was skewed over from, well, actually it was pretty much the same where they'd used paper ballots, but where the electronic votes were there was this kind of skewing of the vote actually indeed, over to indeed, the Republican
indeed,
candidate.
And that's prima facie evidence of fraud. When you put electoral observers into a place like Afghanistan or the Philippines or Northern Ireland to look about whether there's been fraud, or the Ukraine, for example, one of the first things you check is whether the exit poll and the poll tallies, because the wider the gap between the exit poll and the actual poll, the larger the suspicion.
Now let's be absolutely clear here. The exit poll is what's taken, is the most accurate poll, supposedly. It's as people are leaving.
People may still lie in an exit poll and say they've voted for somebody they haven't voted for, but by and large, they tend to tally almost exactly. And if they don't tally, then that sets alarm bells ringing. Now, the Western media called the election in Ukraine a couple of years ago a fraud because the tally was out by something like 3%. In the US elections, the tally was out by 5%. But of course, what the media then said, oh, well, we must have got it wrong. The exit poll must have been wrong. No, the exit poll wasn't wrong. US elections are fraudulent. And don't forget that elections in Mexico have always been fraudulent. And you've always found the pro-US candidates winning elections in Mexico. So it's not just to do with electronic fraud. You've got to watch out for all kinds of fraud. In the modern era, we don't just have straightforward dictatorship. What we have is managed democracy, so that people are allowed to vote and get the feeling that they're somehow participating, but the result is a foregone conclusion because it's being rigged behind the scenes. It's a real problem all over the world. And don't forget that Diebold, who provide these machines, are big contributors to Republican Party funds, so they're not even politically neutral.
Now, so which countries have adopted electronic voting? I mean, is there any prospect of it happening in Britain?
Interestingly enough, Venezuela has used electronic voting. But they've always had a paper ballot as a check.
So what's the point of that? I mean, what is the point of having two separate votes at the same time?
There's no point, really. I mean, if you're going to have a paper ballot as a check, you might as well stick with a paper ballot. I think electronic voting is open to fraudulent manipulation. It's quite clear. Not only is it open, it has been manipulated. So, I mean, the reasons we have all of these ballot boxes and the boring pencils and counting by hand and all the rest of it is to avoid this kind of perception. Even the perception of fraud is extremely damaging. But it's not the perception.
Why is it that if people just think there may be fraud, why can that be damaging?
Well,
because
then the legitimacy of the election is open to doubt. And in a place like the Philippines, where if people doubt the election, they may decide to go back to guerrilla warfare against the government, you've potentially created a situation where, I don't know, the New People's Army in the Philippines, who are the sort of militant radical opposition, may decide not to participate in elections at all if they're rigged. And don't forget, in the Philippines, just like in Colombia, it's not just fraud that goes on. There is assassination and murder of political opponents is routine. There's a fantastic Unreported World documentary about the Philippines that was on a couple of years ago now, and it's quite obvious that radical forces in the Philippines, just as in Colombia and other parts of the world, face a constant attack, physical attack, from the forces behind electoral fraud.
But do you think there's any prospect of this being introduced in the UK, and has it been used so far in Britain?
I don't believe that it has, and I think given the experience of what we've seen in the rest of the world, we'd be very foolish if we were to adopt such a system. Our system is a bit creaky and a bit old-fashioned, but it takes quite a while for the results to come out. But I mean, you know, all of those checks and balances are terribly, terribly important. And if you think about places like Northern Ireland, people have got to be absolutely confident that the result is the right result and that everybody's vote has been genuinely counted, because otherwise one faction or another may decide that they're not going to play by the rules anymore and we're back to bombs and bullets. So it's very important.
What about this whole business of software that isn't necessarily doing what you think it's doing? Because, I mean, I use the computer quite, you know, every day pretty much, and when I click something, how do I know that what I'm clicking is actually what's taking place? Well,
exactly, and I think that doubt is going to be there unless you've got an absolutely foolproof system, as they've got in Venezuela, where you cast an electronic ballot and you also cast a paper ballot simultaneously. And I suppose what it means is that you can get the result from the electronic ballot and then check it against the paper ballot, so you can get a quicker result.
But how do you get the balance? Because, you know, with Microsoft Windows, for example, it's all copyrighted and also what's called closed source. So even people who are experts in computers and software engineers are not allowed to actually have a look at what is going on when you click something under Microsoft Windows.
Well, what seems to have happened in the US elections is that you only cheat in the key constituencies where you need to cheat in order to get your guy over the line. Yeah, so rigging elections has long been a massive specialism of the Western intelligence services, particularly the CIA. So there's all kinds of tools in that rigging elections box.
So do you think there are other countries?
One is controlling the media. Two is intimidating people, killing people if they're too dangerous. I mean, that's another way that democracy is controlled. If you kill somebody, this is what happens in Colombia. You can stand for the election if you like, but you won't be alive on election day. And that, of course, deters people from coming forward to stand for election and so on.
So do you think there are other countries where this kind of thing is going on with companies like Diebold?
I think what's happening now is that intelligence services in the West have been using electoral manipulation for years. In the East Bloc countries, they never used to bother with electoral manipulation because elections were just a fraud, you know, just a deliberate fraud all the way down the line. But once you've got a semi-free system, then fraud becomes a very, very important... I mean, the temptation for fraud, especially if you're a power elite in a particular country, and losing power means you lose access to, you know, sources of income, sources of bribes and so on, there's always going to be the temptation to try and rig the election. Elections are obviously going to be open to be rigged by powerful forces who want to try and rig them. That's why you've got to have a very strong system in place to prevent that happening.
But surely the old paper ballot system is also open to abuse.
Well, it is indeed. I mean, what happens in the US before they brought in electoral fraud, electronic electoral fraud, is that they used to rely on good old-fashioned rigging the ballot without electronics. So the hanging chads fiasco in Florida, where lots of people were forced off the electoral register because they were claimed to be those with criminal records and so on and so forth. Basically, we should be very, very cautious about changing anything about our electoral system in this country. In Northern Ireland, there was a problem with electoral fraud for many years, but that it was put right by very, very, you know, solid work by all concerned. And I think that that was absolutely essential to the peace process, that everybody felt that their votes were being properly counted and that there was no cheating going on. Now, I think that's very important.
Now, apparently, the military around the world, or various militaries around the world, are also looking at their software on their all their various different systems to see if it's possible to hack into that. That now, you know, it's all one thing talking about election software being hacked into, but if the military are involved in defending the country and suddenly they find that their software's hacked...
That's a military problem, for a wider kind. But I think what's happened with Diebold in the US, it was deliberately designed to be hackable by certain people. It's not just accidental that it was hackable. As many people will know, all Windows software is accessible by the US National Security Agency.
Oh, is it?
Yes. this was an agreement made between Microsoft and the US National Security Agency. So everybody should know that if you're using Windows software, what you are doing can be seen by the US National Security Agency, by Echelon.
Okay, Martin, well, that's a little bit disturbing thought to leave things on this week. But anyway, that's all for this week. Coming up next, I hope, is the Sky News at 7. I hope it's not Blondie again. I don't know why we seem to be getting...
Yes, the news seems to have been stopped by pop music.
It does. It's been taken over by pop music. And it's something I'm afraid I really simply do not understand why that is. Anyway, I hope you've had enough news on here as well. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2. If you've got a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or want to suggest a guest for a future show, go to www.thisweek.org.uk or email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to our guests, Chair of Bristol Public Safety and Protection Committee and Labour Councillor for Lawrence Hill, Brenda Hugill, and Crispin Aubrey from the Stop Hinkley campaign, and of course to reporter Marina Morris and resident old Labour economist Martin Summers. Next week, Lib Dem Councillor for Clifton, Trevor Blythe, will be here helping us to navigate through the week's news. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and let's have our fingers crossed we may now have the Sky News at 7. Thanks very much.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.